Hello, I'm Martin Kessler, and you're listening to Flix Boys Canada. Joining me for this episode is filmmaker and film expert Daniel Bird.
Thank you for inviting me to take part in this discussion. It's a real pleasure and a real honor to be part of this series of podcasts.
Thank you for coming on. Usually on the show, we get into the plots or themes of the films and sort of dissect them, but this is coming at it from a little bit of a different perspective. I was excited when you pitch the topic, which is the physical and ephemeral nature of film itself, because it's, in some ways, I think it's a little bit misunderstood, the physical nature of film, and it might become increasingly misunderstood as the digital becomes more prevalent.
It's also a generational thing. So I'm 41. So when I really got into this in my teens, that was in the 1990s. So you were really limited with regards to what you could see by what was on television, what was available on video, and what was on the repertory circuit in the cinemas. And while there were some fantastic retrospectives in my late teens, there were the BFI did new copies of Antonioni's films, Le Mépris by Godard, Les Yeux sans Visage by Franju, all films which made a big impression on me. But there was also this whole business of reading about films in books like Film as a Subversive Art by Amos Vogel, or The Czechoslovak New Wave by Peter Hames. And they all had these remarkable stills and descriptions, but there was no real way to see these films. The only way to see them was on a Steenbeck by either renting a 16 or 35 millimeter print. And that was incredibly expensive, so that really led to this whole business of programming films for purely selfish reasons. This was the only way to see short films by Borovchik or The Deserter Nomads by Yuri Akobisko. So I think this whole business of writing about films and programming films is intrinsically connected with the materiality of film. And even to this day, you know, there is this assumption that everything is available either on streaming or on not-so-legal websites on the internet. But the truth of the matter is that there's an awful lot of films which aren't available, and you do have to go into the archives. You do have to confront legal issues with regards to ownership and access to those prints, both in archival conditions and if you want to screen them in public. Who has the rights and things like that. And of course, if you don't address those issues, those films are in effect, they're not available and they don't exist. And that may change the way you perceive either a filmmaker or a national cinema or a certain trend in cinema. And I think that's really what happened with the work I was involved with, both with Andrzej Żuławski and Valerian Borowczyk, because in Borowczyk's case, many of those early films, the short films from the 1960s, his early features, were out of distribution. So the whole business of locating those elements, resolving the rights, finding a distributor which was sympathetic to the attempt to remaster them and redistribute them, all of those issues were connected. So I do think it's an important issue, and the idea that films are they're just there and they're just available on cassette or digitization. No, that's far from the truth. My job half the time is either confronting legal issues about who owns what, finding materials, and then working out how on earth to pay for a transfer or a restoration. It's really banal, but if you don't confront those issues, those films simply don't enter distribution. And if they're not in distribution, they cannot be talking points. And I think one of the great things about films, whether it's Cristalli of My Car or a film like Go to Island of Love or The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne or The Silver Globe or Parajanov's Outtakes, they have become talking points. And I think one of the reasons is that it was a surprise. You couldn't see these things and suddenly they're there in kind of good condition. And it's a shock. It's a shock in this contemporary cinema landscape. They are not like things you can see on Netflix or whatever streaming platform, they are slightly alien. They're like Martian moon landings. Yeah, Martian moon landings. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, double weirdness. Yeah.
On the Silver Globe is a Martian moon landing.
Exactly.
I was wondering, too, about the process of scanning, remastering, restoring. How much interpretation goes into working with whatever elements are available and creating the final product? I know in some cases it can be a little bit controversial. One thing I really appreciated was for the recent Color of Pomegranates release, it had both the Russian version and Armenian version. I know it's not always feasible, but for some of these films, there's multiple versions or a sort of Rashomon idea of how these films should be presented or look.
I think those are crucial points. I mean, the first thing to say is that it's very nice and very flattering and good for the ego to be described as an expert on film restoration. The truth is, I'm not. I'm more of a producer, and I'm kind of like reining in the different elements and entrusting people, whether it's James White in the case of the Borowczyk restorations with Arrow, or Łukasz Szaranka and Wojtek Janio, with whom I worked with on the Silver Globe. But it's really a dialogue, and I think that dialogue has to include philologists, film historians, in the case of The Color of Pomegranates. This restoration was carried out by Bologna Cinematheque, and it involved the employment of James Stefan, who's done a considerable amount of archival research at Argali, the Russian State Literature Archive. And not only did he kind of collate and commission the translation of those production memos, but he analysed them in such a way as that they provided a guide with regards to the complicated production history. And James and myself had contacted various crew members, like the production designer Stepan Andranikan, who could at least consult on the look and shape of the film. And so I think there's a lot of educated guesswork with regards to The Color of Pomegranates. The version I saw was the version I think most people saw, which was the Yudkevich, the Russian so-called version of the film. So that version of the film, Parajanov made his director's cut in Armenia. He wasn't entirely happy with it in accordance to, which judging by the documents in Argali, which James kind of unearthed, but nevertheless, he did have control over it. He may have been forced to finish work on it without full satisfaction, but nevertheless, he did have control. And then the project was re-edited. Yes, there was some degree of ideological concerns which shaped the restructuring of the film, but most of the debate in those production memos concerns audience comprehensibility, which I think is no different from many of the debates which take place in not just film studios in Hollywood, but also local film industries. So it was demystifying that through archival work. And I think that there came a point, both James and I were consulted on the Bologna restoration, and we were asked at one particular moment which version to restore, which version was going to be presented in Cannes in about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I actually proposed the Yudkevich version because this version had been in wider circulation. James quite rightly suggested that it had to be the Armenian version, and I deferred to that decision. And then Bologna were faced with the complicated task of reconstructing the Armenian version by combining a duplicate negative with the Russian version, which was the cut negative version. So they had to combine elements from both the original camera negative, which was recut by Yudkevich in Moscow, with the duplicate negative, which existed in Yerevan. So when that version was presented, and then when I was approached by the English distributor to supervise and produce the UK Blu-ray release, it was very important for me to include both versions and those production memos which James had drawn attention to, because there isn't a definitive version of the film as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Both versions are important. Parajanov was initially incensed with what Yudkevich did, but later in life he came to the conclusion that Yudkevich had in fact saved his film. He'd satisfied the demands of the Goskino in Moscow, their kind of concerns about the what they would take from Armin film in order to distribute it throughout the Soviet Union, and retaining the integrity, the essence of the film. And very interestingly, the structure of the Yudkevich version actually is closer to Parajanov's original literary script, and it was a structure which Parajanov himself used in his subsequent films, The Legend of Sarami Fortress and Ashik Kharib. That is, Parajanov wrote the film as 15 cinematic miniatures, and he deviated from that in the shooting and editing. But Yudkevich actually returned to that kind of like the poet's childhood, the poet in love, and the poet's death. So for me, yeah, it was necessary to present the work not as a closed text, but an open text, a film made up of multiple variants, a film which exists in a literary version, a film which exists in production memos, and in an ideal world, a film which existed in 7 or 8 hours of outtakes, which I wasn't able to include, but subsequently I've done some work transferring and restoring those outtakes and finding unusual ways of presenting them in an installation context. So I think it's interesting how one approaches the work, and I think we do fetishize the idea of a director's cut. It's not always simple.
No, and I mean, sometimes a filmmaker's idea of what their own film is can change over time. I don't know if you've run into any instances where the filmmaker is still alive and maybe wanted to tweak their version of the film, maybe not so much trying to present the film as it was originally seen, but what they intended.
I think that's an important issue, particularly with regards to color timing, when you involve either directors of photography or filmmakers themselves in the color grading process. In my experience, at the very beginning, when I was involved in this, I would say, what would you like to do? And now I'm quite firm in saying that, look, you're here to ensure that the film looks how it did when it was released. We're not here to revise or change the film. Having said that, in the case of On the Silver Globe, the version, the restored copy, doesn't look like the release copies. And as far as I'm concerned, there was a legitimate reason for the difference between the version which we presented at Lincoln Center and which subsequently played at festivals, and the version which played in Cannes in 1988. And that is that the film was shot using very extensive filters, which in turn were kind of color corrected or in the color timing process. For example, the first part of the film, I mean, the film is in three parts and they all have a distinctive look, but the first part had a heavy, heavy green filter, which was then compensated for in the processing stage. The rationale was, according to both Andrzej Jaroszewicz, the cinematographer, and Andrzej Żuławski, is that they felt that if the film, for whatever reason, was taken away from them in post-production — the irony was it was taken away from them in production — but if it was taken away from them in post-production, it would be impossible for anybody to correct the colours, because they'd made those colour manipulations in camera and not during post-production. But the problem was is that this is the 1980s, and it went into production in the 1970s. Poland was still part of the Eastern Bloc, and they were printing, not on Kodak, but this Orvo East German film stock. And the release prints made in 1988, and they made some more prints for a touring retrospective about 10 years ago, are very, very dark and murky. And I know that when we were trying to release the film on DVD about 10 years ago, Żuławski was deeply upset and irritated by the fact that you couldn't see the actors' faces. And this wasn't simply a problem with the telecine. It was simply that there was no information on the copy which they were using. But when we scanned the negative, and that was the source of the restoration. And, of course, when you're scanning from the negative, you have to completely retime it in terms of colour, which is why it's necessary to involve the cinematographer, if possible. it's necessary to consult copies, but we were presented with an image which had much more clarity, much more definition, much more detail than it ever had in any release prints. So it was necessary to kind of reinvent the look. And you're in this absurd situation, which I think is not really explored in such detail. And that is that when you're actually making a restoration, a lot of people think that your goal is to make it look how it looked in the cinemas. And when you're scanning from the negative, this is impossible, because when you shoot on the negative, then you then make your kind of your lavender, your interpositive, from which you make a dupe negative, from which you strike the release prints. So you actually lose four generations because through the printing process. So, and a good example is The Wizard of Oz with Victor Fleming, in the way that he knew that nobody would see the wires holding up the flying monkeys, because by the time you'd lost those generations, the definition would go and you wouldn't see the wires. Of course, when you scan the negative now in 4 or 8 or 10K, whatever, you see the wires. And then you're confronted with an ethical decision. Do you leave the wires in? Because you would never see the wires if you saw a release print. Or do you remove the wires using digital post-production?
Right.
A good example of that is Suspiria, in the way that the German restoration of Suspiria, I believe, I've not actually seen it, but I'm led to believe that they actually removed the wires on the bat scene.
Oh, digitally.
Yeah, but the Synapse version, of which the actual digital cleanup work was done in Poland with the same company that did the Silver Globe, Synapse and Luciano Tavoli, the DOP, asked for all this to be left in. So, you know, you do see the wires in holding up the bat, but I don't have a problem with that. And
no.
But it is a decision you're confronted with. So, and there was one shot in the Silver Globe when they do the vertigo shot, the track and zoom. And of course they were doing it with rather crude technology. There was only ever one camera on the whole of the shoot of the Silver Globe, and Yaroshevich, the DOP, asked if we could smooth the track and zoom out. At that particular moment, Zhuwevsky was too sick to really offer any feedback, although I did contact him about it. He just made it very clear. He said, "Look, I'm dying. I'm not interested." that's what you're involved in. I mean, that's the reality.
Yes.
And then you have to make a judgment call. And I chose to smooth that shot out, although it's not like that in the release print. But that was the intention of the filmmakers. And the jerkiness of the track and zoom is distracting. So I thought it was a legitimate reason to take it out. So the conclusion is that I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. And I don't think it's simple. And I think you have to make a lot of judgment calls and on a case-by-case basis. So, yeah, the Silver Globe restoration doesn't look how the release prints look, but I do think that the reception of the film, which was much better second time around than it was first time around, has a lot to do with the fact that you can actually see the film in a way you couldn't see the film first time around.
For some people, it might seem nitpicky, but it does change your perceptions of a film when it looks a little bit different or feels a little bit different. There are films I remember seeing in the theater projected very colored very warmly, and then seeing them later and there's these Blu-rays which look much cooler and bluer.
Can you give any specific examples?
Well, a recent one was the Terrence Malick film The New World, where I had a very vivid memory of it being warmly colored in the theater, sort of warm natural tones, and then the Criterion Blu-ray, it's much cooler tones, and of course the cinematographer and director were involved, so I wasn't sure if that was an instance of maybe that's how it was always meant to be seen and what I'd seen was a fluke when it first came out, or if it's slightly changing their vision. I don't really know the backstory why, but it's definitely different than how I remember seeing it, and it leaves a little bit of a different impression.
Well, I think that the first thing to say is that, and I think it's something which isn't discussed as much as it should be discussed, is that a Technicolor print made in London is not going to look the same with a Technicolor print made in Rome, and the way that there is no real consistency, and that takes on a whole different level in the Soviet Union. Valery Posner, an excellent film historian based in Paris. She's been doing a lot of archival work into colour cinematography during the interwar and post-war period. And most of those memos are concerned with the chemical process and the inconsistency of colours and prints. To give a specific example, Valerie was translating for Alexei German when he came to Paris shortly after my friend Ivan Lapshin. And German was sensitive to the fact that the colour or the sepia, rather, or the combination of colour and sepia was different mm-hmm. from the copy in Gosfilmofond and the copy at the Lem Film Studio. And he was very agitated about which version was being screened, and the version being screened was invariably the one he felt which wasn't how it should be. There was an incident recently with Tarkovsky's Stalker, in the way that the sepia...
It's yellow now.
Well, I spoke to someone, I mean, they corrected this in the Potemkin release in France, and I spoke to a colleague who had one explanation, and that was that in the technical transcripts, there was no distinction between sepia and black and white, and that probably explains how something had gone from sepia to black and white.
And I think in that case, the negative was lost, right? For Stalker.
Well, I mean, that film had such a complicated production history, as you know.
Yes.
But on top of that, you have the other issue whereby if you've got a print which includes both colour and black and white elements, they will often print black and white in colour, which is not true black and white. Which is why, and to give you, I mean, a good example of like, you know, if you've seen a print of Raging Bull, and you've got the Super 8 color.
On the color film stock, it's black and white on the color film.
Exactly. And it's inconsistent with the black and white reels which follow. And whereas in the case of like Borofchik, when he did his short film Renaissance and subsequently the Diptych, another short film, and most notably Go to Island of Love, he was very sensitive to this black and white on color stock not looking like black and white. So what he did, he shot the film in black and white and then shot the colour sequences in colour and then actually sent to distributors the 35mm film in black and white with a separate reel of the colour inserts to be spliced into it. And this way you get proper black and white, you get proper colour. Of course, you lose a frame for the splicing,
right.
But that was a necessary sacrifice for Borofchik. The problem was is that most of the distributors didn't splice in the colour sequences, so there were a lot of copies of that film, including early video releases, which I'm slightly embarrassed to see that my ranting about this 20 years ago on Amazon is still actually there. It was a master produced for Australian TV, probably from a 16mm black and white print without the colour. It's sadly still there, but probably didn't have a girlfriend at the time, but it was a huge importance, the fact that the colour was missing. But it was a great pleasure when working on the restoration with James White that we found I think it was the only colour element of the, which was actually a 16mm source, I think. And then that was scanned and then kind of spliced or substituted into the film. And then this made another issue for me when I worked on a Polish restoration. He did a short film called The School, Szkoła, in 58. And this film is made up of black and white photographs, which he re-photographed to give a kind of pixelation effect. And at the end of the film, there's like legs which appear in colour, in red and in blue. And now in the prints of the film, this again had this kind of black and white on colour film. But with digital scanning and processing, I made the decision, rightly or wrongly, that the black and white should be pure black and white and the colour should be pure colour. Again, these are ethical issues, and I think that you have to make a judgment call That judgment call was based on the decisions Borowczyk made with both Renaissance and Go to Island of Love, how he specifically wanted pure black and white and pure colour. So I felt that was a legitimate decision in justifying this deviation from colour prints, let's say.
Right.
So, you know, it's I think it's complicated, and it requires a judgment calls in many cases. I don't think there are hard and fast rules.
No. But if you have an informed decision, or if you are familiar with the filmmaker, it definitely makes it maybe more justifiable, certain decisions, or you can remove some of the gray area, it seems like. I don't know if research is an important part of coming to these decisions.
I think it is. I think it's a combination of a number of factors. The first is I do place a great amount of importance on oral interviews, especially with cinematographers and directors, to ascertain their intentions, at least. On top of that, archival work, and then also initial reports, reviews of the film, how critics write about the film, particularly in terms of their experience of the film, in terms of colour, when they're describing a palette. And remember, critics back in the day used to be much more sensitive about things like the colour and sound of a film rather than they are now. So those are useful, I think. So, you know, I think that those are all... I mean, to give you there's a film which I would love to see restored. It's a film I'm very close to, but it's in kind of limbo at the moment, and that's Jure Jakubisko's The Deserter and Nomads.
And yes, it's a brilliant film.
It's a wonderful film. And that film, I have a very close relationship with, because I met Jakubisko in 98, and I did an interview with him, and then he said that his idea of hell was being in a screening room, being forced to watch your own films because you only see your mistakes. And the irony was is that the only film which he was happy with was The Deserter and Nomads. But the painful thing, the negative of The Deserter and the Nomads was missing. And when I was preparing a retrospective of Jakubisko for the BFI, that was in 2004, by accident, I actually traced the negative, and it was in Los Angeles, of all places. So they made a new copy of the film for the Slovak Film Archive, which was played at Jakubisko's birthday, I think the 65th anniversary in 2003. And when we were talking about this and we did an interview, he said that there were colour effects in the first episode of the film. And if you've seen a copy of that film, particularly in 35mm, it jumps between two kind of colour looks. One's a very acidic look, and one's much more naturalistic, veering on the green and red. And he said he shot a combination of reversal stock and negative stock and processed it accordingly. He said this was as much to do with budgetary constraint as it was artistic difference. The fact that he wanted to shoot in colour, they didn't want to give him colour stop because it was a second movie, and so he decided to pad it out with reversal stock, and so it was a processing effect. I mean, Jakubisko's background was in photography, so he was very sensitive to all of these kind of color manipulations in the chemical phase. So can you imagine a situation whereby that negative gets scanned, and then if you were unfamiliar with that interview, you'd probably correct those colours to make it consistent. So for me, it's vital to actually have the director on record drawing attention to the fact that these are intentional colour differences, and it was a colour effect. You don't want to correct this. You don't want to make it homogenised. And so you do have to go out of your way to do these interviews, to do this archival work. And one of the things I've tried to do is to try and say that, look, we shouldn't specialize too much. We shouldn't actually say, well, this is just a purely technical exercise. We should make something much more homogeneous, where we're bringing in the expertise of people in academia, in film historians, and the filmmakers themselves. And we should be establishing a dialogue which can both satisfy the filmmaker, the film historian, and the distributor, and above all else, the film goer.
I mean, that's interesting, the combination of reversal with negative film. When I was in film school, I shot on reversal color film because I was cheapskate, and it sort of makes it easier. You don't have to go through the usual process that it comes out ready to project. But I know sometimes, especially like some Russian films, you hear about them shooting on basically whatever they could get a hold of as far as film stock. And sometimes you do have a little bit of these Frankenstein films.
That's very common. And that's something which Valerie has really kind of drawn attention to in her research the last couple of years. The fact that, you know, the number of occasions when film is kind of cobbled together from various different sources. I mean, the most famous example, of course, is Ivan Grozny, where the color footage is actually stolen from Germans during the Second World War. It was, you know, the spoils of war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not always the case that the negative is the best available material, but usually, you know, if it's in good condition, it is. There is an irony, and that is that if the film was, for example, very successful, like Les Enfants du Paradis, of course, then they repeatedly return to the negative to make more interpositives and more dupe negatives to strike new prints. So the negative gets more wear and tear and prone to more damage, whereas a film like The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne by Borowczyk, which was a disaster, the negative was immaculate. And in the case of Krustalia of My Car, the negative for that film, the last reel of the negative is missing. No one knows where it is. And it's shocking to think of a film which is so important, and it's only from 1998, but the negative is missing. So they had all but one reels of the negative in Gosfilmo Fund, and they had a Lavanda interpositive in Paris, which was, after all, it was a French co-production, as you know. So the decision was chosen. I mean, I guess you could have scanned from the negative and then gone to the interpositive for the final reel, but there is an economic issue. You know, right. It's very expensive to scan, and this was done through a commercial distributor without subsidies. The Color of Pomegranates was financed by the Material World Foundation, so this was like a charitable heritage project, whereas Krustalia of My Car was done through a commercial distributor, and you have to work within those parameters. So the decision was made to work from the Lavanda, the interpositive, which was in good condition, and it was scanned in 2K for two reasons: one, economic, but also restored to 2K at least, simply because there isn't that much difference. There isn't restoring to 4K from a interpositive, because of course you're losing the detail, so it just becomes, you know, negligible, let's say. And to give another example, there was a film by Maria Sakyan called The Lighthouse, Mayak, which second run released on DVD about 5 or 6 years ago. And Maria, she passed away about a year and a half ago, and I, about this time last year, I met her producer in Yerevan, and we were talking. I knew Maria a little bit, and the producer said that the negative and all the elements had been junked by the Russian laboratory, and there only existed two positive release prints, and one of the release prints was in Gosfilmo Fund, and the other positive release print belonged to the producer. So I said that given the fact there was no high-definition materials available, the producer, Victoria, she should just, by hook or by crook, just get that print to Warsaw, and I will get it scanned for posterity more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And in the end, we did some basic color correction and projected it on the anniversary of Maria's death. But in scanning that print, because it was made in 2006 and they'd used for parts of the film, like the credit sequences, a digital intermediate, and they didn't keep or archive the digital intermediate files or project files, there isn't actually that much resolution. So although we scanned it in 4K for posterity, given the fact that this was the best available element, on the 35mm, there wasn't that resolution there, you know, because of the process. So you know, it's a strange and frustrating sometimes process.
In that process of going from film to digital, in some cases even back to film for distribution. I don't know if certain things can become easily lost.
Well, I think it's important to say that from my point of view, I would say that the films I'm most concerned about are actually of the last 20, 30 years, because particularly with this transition to digital. I don't know about you. I mean, I've got archiving issues with my old DV cassettes and old mini discs.
Absolutely.
And it's impossible these days. It's really a chore to basically find someone with a DV player if I need to access old DV cassettes.
I mean, as an archival material, film is still probably more stable than any kind of digital format. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the films that have been shot digitally and only ever exist digitally become lost in the next 50 years.
Well, I can give you a specific, there's a Polish film, not bad at all, from about 10 or 12 years ago when they shot it digitally, and there's a flawed transfer to 35mm, but all the digital elements have been lost. So the only record of this film is a flawed 35mm transfer. And this is a film, I don't know, it's like 10 years old. And so it is a major concern. And then on top of that, I've been working on a project this last few years to really nurture a culture of preservation and restoration in the Caucasus and Central Asia. And it's called the Hamo Beknazarov Project. And that's for two reasons. One is that really, I think the backbone of the project is to restore Beknazarov's films, particularly silent films, but also the ethos, the spirit of his work, the fact that he worked throughout the Caucasus and Central Asia, and also his values. But as part of the proposal, as part of the goal, it's to not only restore the films, but to actually make 35mm archival elements, to reverse engineer, if you're going to restore, scan in 4K and restore to 4K, to reverse engineer a new, negative in 4K, which is very expensive. It's quite reasonable to make 35mm release prints, especially in 2K, but to actually make an archival kind of 35mm negative element, it's extremely expensive. But the reason for doing that is that if it's an archival project, then you want something that's going to last, and you don't want LTO tapes or hard drives or anything else.
Of course,
because you know, we all had experiences of hard drives sticking and failing.
Yes. But I mean, some countries, I don't know if they don't necessarily have that backing to make prints for everything, so it must be difficult to sort of sift through and decide what should be restored, what should be focused on. I don't know how much of that is based on the materials available, how much of that's based on what interest there might be in a particular filmmaker, or there must be a lot of factors involved in that.
Well, from my experience, I mean, this all really started when I was producing that Color of Pomegranates release, because it was my initial goal. I wanted to include the outtakes, and I wanted to include three short films. Hakopov Natanian, a short film on a portrait painter, which he made during the pre-production of The Color of Pomegranates. Kiev Frescoes, which he made camera tests for, but the film was cancelled. But then a short film was made from those camera tests. This was in Ukraine a few years before, in sort of 66. And I think that it's particularly important to include that film because the aesthetic which we associate with Parajanov, particularly his later work, it's there in an embryonic stage. But most jarringly, the film is a contemporary film, and it doesn't have the kind of ethnographic characteristics which distinguish Parajanov's later work, this so-called Caucasus trilogy. So it was important to include that. And then the third film is Arabesques on the theme of Pirasmani, which is another idiosyncratic documentary on the Georgian naïf painter Pirasmani. And in the case of Hakopov Natanian, because it was produced by the Haik Film Studio, which is the documentary studio, and because it was conceived of as an educational film for a domestic audience, the negative stayed in Armenia. Now, when you made a film or a feature film, and it was usually what would happen is that to offset the costs, they would be distributed throughout the Soviet Union and exported sometimes abroad. So the negatives would go to Moscow and be deposited in Gosfilmfond. So I was particularly interested in titles where the negatives were staying in Yerevan, in Armenia. And so that's why I settled on Hakopov Natanian, because if you're going to do a restoration project, a short film is preferable because it's 10 minutes as opposed to 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you know, if you're working from a negative, it's going to look much better than if you're working from a release print. So those were factors in choosing those titles. On top of that, I think by actually I presented those three films and called it rather pretentiously Parajanov triptych at the Rotterdam Festival.
No, that's lovely.
And the reason for that is twofold. And the first is that basically short films are incredibly difficult to program. On top of that, they're very expensive to program because they end up costing much more than a feature film equivalent. And I started to think, well, maybe I could present it as a thing in itself. So, and these were three films made by a Soviet filmmaker, but in three different countries. And they have a uniform quality, but at the same time, they're specific to the cultures in which they were made. And I think that, in a nutshell, really draws attention to the problems with dealing with this kind of Soviet heritage. And that is that, you know, when I first saw these films, they were all Soviet films, which was really Russian films. Now, the fact is, they're not really Russian films. These are Georgian films, Armenian films, and Ukrainian films.
Yes.
And they become subject to nationalist rhetoric. So basically, you know, Parajanov became the kind of the repository of Armenian culture and then Ukrainian culture and Georgian culture. Mm-hmm. And the fact is what's so interesting about the production histories of those films is that it's more complicated than that. The Color of Pomegranates was not just shot in Armenia. A lot of it was shot in Georgia. The some scenes were shot in Baku in Azerbaijan, and the studio work was done in Kiev, and the montage was done in Kiev and then re-edited in Moscow. So, you know, it's more complicated. It can't be reduced to one single country, and I think that that's something which I'm trying to get around. And I think we're trying to get away from this idea of nationalist film histories, the fact that you have half of Parajanov's filmography in Ukrainian cinema, and then one film, the most important, in Armenian cinema, and then a few in Georgian cinema. And the biggest irony of all is that Ashiq Karib is mostly shot in Azerbaijan immediately before the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. So what do you do now? And the fact that, you know, it's impossible to have any form of cooperation on a cultural activity between Azerbaijan and Armenia, but here you have films which were shot by an Armenian in Azerbaijan, like Beknazarov. Beknazarov, House on the Volcano is an Armenian-Azeri co-production. Seville is one of the most, if not the most important, Azeri films from that 1920s period, and yet it's directed by an Armenian, which was not a problem then, but it's a big problem now, and I think it's one of the major factors why that film is not more widely known. So I'm just trying to draw attention to this, what is in effect a post-colonial discourse, the fact that basically the negatives are mostly in Moscow and you have all of these countries which used to be part of the Soviet Union trying to reformulate a sense of national identity and turning to these films, which were so problematic during the Soviet period because of their perceived nationalist tendencies.
Yes.
And, you know, and so basically I think that I have to be Switzerland. I have to be this neutral force. I have to use cinema as something which transcends national rhetoric. And you have to basically say that, look, good cinema can be in Armenia and it can be in Azerbaijan. You know, because when you're dealing with these films, look, Armenia is a de facto state of war with Azerbaijan. Georgia's been invaded by Russia. Ukraine's at war with Russia. So how do you deal with all of this when it comes to cultural work and activity? How do you deal with, like, what situation with Germán? Because Germán has a very complex and interesting relationship with the Putin era in terms of basically being honoured for Hrustalev Mashinu, but at the same time benefiting from the Minister of Culture during the making of Trudno bit Bogom, but at the same time, right at the end of his life, being very explicit about the subtext of the film. Specifically the opening scene with the shit house and how that correlated with the comment by Putin regarding Chechens.
Right. I know some of his interviews, he was very open about his intentions with it and why he felt the film was relevant subject matter again, yeah.
But he wasn't always explicit about that during the production.
Right.
I mean, there's a very, very good documentary by a Swiss filmmaker called Anton Katin, and he did a wonderful film, I think it's called Playback, and he learned Russian,
yeah.
And he moved to Petersburg, and he was filming throughout the duration of Hard to Be a God in both the Len film and also the Czech Republic, and the interviews he made with Gehrman, he's very cagey.
Well, it's if you're going to bite the hand that feeds
exactly.
you, it makes sense to wait a little bit until it
exactly.
you're done digesting.
Exactly. So it's very. I think it's a very interesting document, and I think it's mm-hmm. a great shame that documentary is not more widely seen. But I think it's a remarkable film in terms of complementing the latter part of Gehrman's artistic legacy.
Yes. There was a documentary included on the Khrushchelyev Makar Blu-ray set that was, I think it mentioned at the very beginning, it was incomplete when the filmmaker passed away, and then
yes,
what was presented was the closest version.
Well, I can be, look, I mean, first and foremost, like, yeah. Khrushchelyev Makar was a dream project for me. Mm-hmm. The way all this happened was the Borovchik box had been quite a big success, and the head of Arrow Video or content basically approached me and Michael Brook, who produced the Borovchik box, and said, okay, what next? And I proposed we should do Francesco Rosi in the 70s or Alexei Gehrman box. Now, the Francesco mm-hmm. Rosi in the 70s didn't happen because all of those Cristaldi films have kind of bound up in Paramount, and they're just all those amazing films like Lucky Luciano and the Mattei Affair, they're restored by Scorsese's Film Foundation, but they're very difficult to get into distribution. So Rosie was out. And then in the case of Gehrman, Hard to Be a God had just played at the Rome Film Festival, and the response was even worse than Khrushchelyev Makar. People forget this. People forget how bad. Just Google the Variety reviews of Hard to Be a God when it played at Rome Film Festival. They are appalling. And in that period from the premiere at the Rome Film Festival, the market value of Hard to Be a God was extremely low. And I know that basically I said, well, okay, if we can't do a Gemma box, let's just do Hard to Be a God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that deal was done in that dark period, let's say. But I think the fortunes of that film started to change. I played at Rotterdam the January the following year. And I think word of mouth, you know, and suddenly it became a lot more interest in that film. And it played at the London Film Festival, and Svetlana Karmeleta came. And I knew on a gut level I did have issues with the subtitles, and so at that mm-hmm. point, basically, I said, "Well, okay, let's do the subtitles from scratch," and I commissioned Angie Klimovsky, who did all the Tarkovsky posters in the '70s for Artificial Eye. So my feeling was that Hard to Be a God should be given a fighting chance by having decent subtitles, which I worked on one summer with Mark Benz, my old neighbor in Warsaw, who's a translator from Russian and French into English. And this is for the English release, not the Kino Lorber release in the States.
Right. I noticed the subtitles were different on the Kino and Arrow.
Well,
releases.
It's yeah. very, I would say, English. And there were little things like, say, for example, in the transcripts supplied by the sales company, they were using the term, like at the beginning, wise guys, and in English,
right.
It's like
yeah.
it's more
yeah.
like bookworms, because it's like yeah, intellectuals.
Yes.
Wise guys is like gangsters, and you're thinking, well, you know, if this isn't a Scorsese film, you know, that mm-hmm. purging the intelligentsia, that's the point. So it's a subtle difference that yeah, they are wise, but they are not wise guys. They are bookworms. So it was necessary to do subtle manipulations, let's say, which I think, and the other interesting thing I think with the subtitles with that film is that, and this was very much the case with Crystal F. My Car, the continuity, when you do a film and you make these continuity transcripts, but Gaiman, because of his approach to sound, he was kind of mixing in and out different voices. Yeah. And so you're faced with the choice what to subtitle and what not to subtitle. And I felt that the transcripts provided by the sales company were just giving way too much information and stuff you couldn't even hear. So basically, Mark and I started making editorial decisions about what line mm-hmm. should be translated, and thus drawing attention to certain elements of dialogue at the expense to others. Now, if you're a Russian speaker, you will be listening to two or three different lines of Russian concurrently
right.
in different volumes. Yeah. But if you're not, then we made the editorial choice. And I think that that was, again, like with the subject of restoration, not necessarily true to the film, but it was a helping hand. And so that kind of worked for Hard to Be God in the UK. It did very well in the UK. It wasn't an immediate success. It was a very good critical success, but it took a while to work with audiences. It was very much a word of mouth release. But then Arrow came back and said, is there anything else we can do? And that's when Crustelli of My Car really came up, because that was the only film which, because it was a French co-production, the foreign rights were held by the French producer. So I tracked down Guy Seligman and proposed that we, make a new copy of Crystal of Makara. And Guy was incredibly receptive. And that's how Crystal of really kind of started as a process. But all those problems with subtitles, we faced them all over again. But it's a challenge. And the fact is that this wasn't a cultural project in terms of like the Film Foundation, or you don't have a benefactor.
Right. You mentioned working with a commercial.
Yeah. I mean, Arrow is a commercial distributor. So, I mean, it was my pitch to Arrow was, when we were discussing Crystal of My Car, you have to remember these things take years. And I knew that Armando Iannucci was doing The Death of Stalin. And I said, this is the prequel to The Death of Stalin, and it would make great counter-programming. But what actually happened is that Crystal of My Car came out much later than The Death of Stalin, and that sentiment had got lost in translation. And in all the promotional campaign, it said the film which inspired The Death of Stalin, which isn't true, and I'm quite certain that Imanda Iannucci hadn't seen the film, and it had nothing to do with it. And I think that if anyone who saw Crystal of My Car expecting a kind of broad comedy is probably going to be shell-shocked, particularly during the second half of the film. So I'm not entirely sure if that was a great idea, but, it's done okay in the UK as far as I know. And I'm thrilled that the film is out, and it's got a nice poster by Andrzej Klimowski. And the release is how I wanted it. I mean, when you're working with a title like Crystal of My Car, you don't have a huge budget. And in the case, to answer your question at long last about the Ron Holloway film, I was in touch with Ron Holloway. He lived in Berlin. I was living in Warsaw at the time. He was sick with cancer, and I knew about this Gaiman film. And at the end of his life, he was trying to complete it, and he didn't complete it. And then when I worked with Bildsterung, which is an excellent distributor in Germany, which frankly speaking laid the groundwork for a lot of the Arrow releases. They were doing Arrow before Arrow. They did the Borowczyk films before Arrow. They did Hard to Be a God before Arrow. When we were working on the German release of Hard to Be a God, I proposed we contact Ron Holloway's widow, who was an actress, a German actress, and she agreed that the actual film which Holloway made could be released if we followed his working editing script. So basically we had a tape, which was a telecine of a 16mm interview with Gaiman made at a German festival after My Friend Ivan Lapshin. And there was a script in which basically the interview was transcribed and edited into English with indications about photographs which were to illustrate what he was talking about, and specific clips from his films. So we had a very strict editing plan to adhere to. In terms of, let's say, editorial finesse, certain decisions were made, like, for example, there wasn't sound of during the sequence with Gehrman mulling around the festival, so because it was for Hard to Be a God, we took the saxophone, kind of, the blues music, and yes, put that on top. But Dorothea had passed away at that point, so we were then dealing with a relative of the family. But I think it's invaluable, these documents. I mean, Ron is an incredible character in terms of actually an American living in West Berlin who wrote books about Bulgarian cinema in the early 1980s. I mean, it's incredible that he had a chance to see all this material and to write about it. I mean, he wrote seminal things on Sokurov very early on in his career. He made that great documentary on Parajanov, which I included on the Second Sight release.
Right.
So, you know, he also made a film on Klimov, and he was a very generous person as well. And I think that to actually have a release, okay, Gehrman doesn't talk about Krystalev in that particular document, but in terms of talking about his work, his father, and his background, I think it's essential.
When I'd written a piece about Alexei Garman, it seemed so kind of spread out, all that information, that to see it all in one place felt very important, actually, for people watching the film for the first time to be able to access that.
Well, I think it's wonderful to have him creating his narrative. And as you know, the fact that, you know, we should not take the filmmaker as gospel. Filmmakers are storytellers, and they do have a tendency to shape their own biographies,
yes,
to their own ends. And but nevertheless, I think that if you were to include a variety of perspectives, both historical and critical, almost like a kind of a cubist portrait, I think one of the things I love about physical media, and I think that there is still the possibility there with streaming sites, is the onus is on the spectator, the onus is on the viewer, the fact that you have the possibility of reading text, of digesting commentaries, and not taking them literally, but formulating your own opinion from often conflicting pieces of information, mm-hmm, and rather than a kind of voice of God narrator telling you what to think, which I think is deeply depressing, unrewarding, and it's a passive experience as a viewer. Right. I liked with Krystalev, I know that you did the podcast and you were discussing the booklet, and I share and I agree with many of the critical comments, but I think it was very important for me to include a very critical text about Krystalev, My Car, by Joël Chaperon, who knew Gehrman, who was involved in the production, mm-hmm, but I think that text of Gehrman forgetting the keys to Krystalev, My Car, and making a film regardless of the spectator in terms of knowing the specific details about the umbrella, the galoshes.
Right.
I think that was important, you know, the fact that it's important not to just have gushing reviews and gushing comments. I think you get so much more out of that critical text.
It's very easy to gush, yeah. It's true. You do need to have other perspectives, and it does help in fleshing it out. I mean, like what you're saying about The Color of Pomegranates not necessarily having a definitive version, it's like with the conversations around these films, sometimes the definitive version isn't this one or that one. It's sort of what exists in between everything spoken about it or everything surrounding it.
I think that it's something which, I mean, when I knew that... I mean, I was joking about this, but it's completely true. And the fact that I was talking to a French producer who was very enthusiastic about this installation I did with outtakes from The Color of Pomegranates, and I was half joking but half being very serious and saying that I was reinventing a DVD extra as conceptual art. And mm-hmm, and by that, I mean, instead of just presenting outtakes, by actually presenting outtakes, you know, on multiple monitors in a specific space with the sound design, it's changing how you as a spectator approach that material. And I think one of the great things about the outtakes of The Color of Pomegranates is the fact that it's presented, it was like one unedited reel per monitor, So there was no editorial intervention on my part on a kind of on that level.
Mm-hmm.
But the process of going into a space and seeing all that information on loops on 24 screens, the film in effect edits itself. And in some ways, I think the influence of The Color of Pomegranate, it's never going to be remembered as a film in terms of its narrative. On the contrary, and this is something flagged up in the production memos, Porajanov has great visual flair, but he's weak on narrative. The influence of The Color of Pomegranate is in, if anything, you know, it's conceptual art and performance art. Marina Abramović is the best example. If you could take this raw material and present it in a gallery, which was part of the one of the reasons for doing this installation, you know, people are less critical about its narrative deficiencies and focus more on the conceptual, gestural, performative aspects of the film. And I think so the context of presenting that material in that kind of conceptual art way kind of highlighted those elements of the film, which I think have really influenced the art world internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that Porajanov's lasting contribution, it's not storytelling. It's not even visual art. It's this performative aspect, which is truly remarkable. So if there was a way of showing that without blah-blahing about it as I'm doing now, that's what I was trying to do. Yeah.
You sent me some pictures of the space. I was really amazed at how it looks, you know, to be able to experience the outtakes like that. It's creating a different experience than, like you said, just watching them on a DVD.
I started the negotiations to loan and transfer that material in spring of last year. And then I met a fantastic film writer, historian, and curator, Edwin Carrolls, who creates the Art Direction Strand at Rotterdam. And we met in London effectively to exchange books. I'd written a book on Borowczyk, and he'd written a book on drawings by the Quay brothers. So we were there meeting for half an hour just to swap books. And we were talking about what we were doing, and I mentioned that I was loaning the outtakes. And he said, you know, it'd be fantastic to do something with them. If you have any ideas, please send me a proposal. And so a few months later, having thought about it, I remembered that famous quote by Godard about Porajanov, about the temple of cinema, and that he was the master within it. I mean, he said these words in the context of a documentary, and I thought, well, could we take that literally? Could we create a literal temple of cinema? So I wrote this on a two sides of A4, this concept, and I sent it to Edwin, and he took it literally. And when I was talking about a kind of a church of cinema, when I came to Rotterdam, he kind of pre-selected possible venues, which were all churches, and that wasn't my initial intention. But one of those churches, called the Arminius Church, it had this fantastic kind of gallery space where you had the possibility of looking down. And it was Edwin's suggestion, well, maybe we could do something with monitors. And we both remembered that scene early on in The Color of Pomegranates when the manuscripts are drying on the roof of the Sanahin Monastery, mm-hmm. and said, well, could we actually have like the monitors as books? And given the fact that the aesthetic of the film is based and derived from Armenian miniatures, it made sense. So we conceived of 24 monitors which could be perceived in close-up, but also have the possibility of looking directly down. And then out of time more than anything else, because we received the material quite late. I initially wanted to re-edit the material, and then over Christmas, like with weeks to go before the opening, I called up Edwin and said, you know, don't think I'm lazy, but I think we should leave the reels exactly how they are, and I think we should leave the leader, and we should leave the full frame with the curves around the edges. And he said, I completely agree, and I'm glad you said that. So it was a very wonderful collaboration. We were both on the same page, and it made an impact which I think neither of us was expecting, because the strange thing is that you have these ideas, but you don't know if they're going to work until the moment it's all there. And it was like months, about a year of work, and we still had no idea whether it would make an impact or not until we turned on all the monitors. And then the Cinema Center of Armenia said, we have to present this in Yerevan. And I have to be honest, I didn't want to do it because I was intimidated. I didn't think we could do it a second time. And the next time I was in Yerevan, I looked at a number of spaces, all of which I wasn't enthusiastic about. And then I said, well, there is this old brutalist Soviet cinema, the Kino Rossiya, the Ararat cinema, which hasn't been in use since the 1990s, which is iconic. It's a landmark. It's right in the middle of Yerevan. And I said, well, look, I've seen photos of the interior. I've never been inside, but I think it would be perfect. So the cinema centre, to the credit, spent months persuading the owner of the cinema, this derelict cinema, to gain access to it. And it kind of was perfect because it was a cinema, but it, as you can see from the photographs, the foyer resembles a church.
Yes.
So it's sort of like this secular church using cinema instead of religion, which of course harks back to those famous articles by Trotsky about vodka cinema and the church in the 20s. And also this idea that cinema transcends national boundaries and religious persuasions. Mm-hmm. So it was a perfect space, and I think that if the initial installation was about drawing attention to the material aspect of film, films as reels, cans of films, you know, cans which are stacked and hidden away, this was also about the heritage of Soviet cinemas. And you have these remarkable, incredible cinemas with this kind of futuristic, brutalist architecture, which is just in ruins. But as cinemas, they just dwarf anything that are being erected today. So it was a possibility to reclaim not just outtakes, but also cinemas. And again, you know, it was a thrilling experience to open that exhibition, to have the smell of incense in this cinema foyer, and to take over this cinema. And I think that most people from Yerevan had known about the cinema, but they'd never been inside, I mean, because it closed in the 90s. So there was this huge curiosity of people going into the cinema just to see what was inside, not necessarily the outtakes. But yeah, you know, so for me, it's been a very interesting exercise, the fact that it's not that I'd gone from producing DVD extras to, no, now I'm a conceptual artist. No, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just what is the most effective way of presenting outtakes. And I'm merely saying that, yes, it can be on a Blu-ray, but it can also be in a old Soviet cinema with the smell of incense in mm-hmm. specially designed tables. And I think it is a wonderful way of engaging with Parajanov's artistic process without any verbal or printed text. There was no text explaining who Parajanov was. There was no text explaining my intentions. There was no text at all. It was just you go in there and you may see pretty images, or you may go in there recognizing the architecture, or you may have preconceived ideas about the symbolic nature of what Parajanov was trying to do. And it became something almost like a jungle gym, you know, but for adults and children, because of course the images, let's not forget, this is very stimulating images for children as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's lots of animals.
Yes. No, it's an inspiring project, I think. Is it all right if I ask you about the shack with the photos of the outtakes guarded by snakes?
The Hay Film Studios, which is on the outskirts of Yerevan, the financial resources of the Soviet industry were kind of focused on Mos film and Lem film, and the kind of the satellite countries were given more modest budgets. But Hay Film Studios was constructed in the 70s, and it's quite an awesome building. But of course it was a Soviet studio, so of course when the Soviet Union collapsed, the kind of the economic lifeline died with it. So when I first visited Hay Film, which was in 2004, it was, you know, it was like a skeleton crew. Electricity was on and off, and there's this constant haze of smoke and cans of film everywhere, and renting out the sound studios just to create a bit of revenue. And And this lingering sense that everybody was just safeguarding an illustrious past. They had this logo of a horse with a rider with a shield, and this was this huge kind of sculpture embossed on the entrance of the building. And a few years later, this just dropped off onto the floor, and everybody interpreted this as of symbolic and spiritual meanings. This was revenge.
Ill omen.
Disgust at what had happened to this remarkable studio. And then I think in about 2005, Kirk Corian had bought it, and there was this talk about investing and renovating the old state studios. And in fact, nothing happened. And if anything, it got worse. And then it was renationalized. So, you know, it's incredible that you have these massively underfunded institutions with these remarkable people doing incredible work, motivated with a sense of pride, national heritage, not necessarily money, to safeguard, you know, this material. And the films themselves, I mean, it's a very hot but fortunately dry environment in Yerevan, but it's not the same archival conditions as in London or in Paris. Mm-hmm. They fight to monitor the temperature with the resources they have, but they don't have, you know, they're not able to freeze negatives and things like this. And so it's kind of like doing everything you can with your available resources. And there was one time when I was going to look at these outtakes. So there's just over 100 cans, and they were all, I asked for them all to be catalogued and spliced together before they were shipped to Poland. And while going there, I was walking through this field in my sandals, and someone said, "Can you just watch out for the snakes?" And I thought they were joking, but no, it's you know, it's there are snakes in the fields and things like this in this time, and then it just really brings into attention, this is actually probably more in keeping with, it's more like Indiana Jones. It's like, you know, in the beginning of the film when he's in the lecture hall as a professor, and then the next he's in the Amazon with the snakes, and you're thinking, well, actually, this is just like this. It's that you're teaching the colour of pomegranates to students in Sheffield, and then the next moment you're working with Armenian state officials walking through a field full of snakes to see the outtakes of Site Nova, and you're thinking, well, you know, everything's come true. Your dream of being Indiana Jones has finally happened.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we have this idealized vision of a film archive and it's stored on some shelf neatly, and then you remember it has to be in some space physically, and things can be stacked here or moved around. Or some films you hear stories about, they found this print in a mental institution. Is that even real, or is that just apocrypha? I never know. Yeah,
it's 100% true. And a good example to give, do you know a film called Cafe Flesh?
Yes,
by Steven Sadian. Yeah, well, I definitely do.
Yes,
I hold this film in very high esteem. I think it's a great film, and but there is a materials problem with this film, and I think this is why a distributor like Vinegar Syndrome really need to be given more credit than they get. I mean, they do get credit, but they need to get even more credit for the simple reason that in the Soviet context, if you make a film, the negative goes to Gosfilm Fund, and it's safe. It's safe. The films after the Soviet Union, they're in trouble, but in the Soviet period, they're safe. The situation with Deserter and Nomads, this is exceptional. The situation with On the Silver Globe, this is exceptional. But by and large, the films I deal with, they go to some central archive and the negatives are safe. The problem with films like Cafe Flesh is because they're essentially conceived and produced as pornographic films. No one gives a shit about the heritage of these films. So they kind of don't pay the rental fees on the negatives. Those get junked or sold if they're lucky, but usually junked. And the physical prints do the rounds, fall apart, go to private hands or just vanish. And so I think that the act from an archival point of view, I think what Vinegar Syndrome are doing is awe-inspiring, given that I know what they're facing.
Yes.
And a film like Cafe Flesh is a good example in the way that there are a couple of prints in various collections in the States, which are in different stages of completion and condition. There's also an internegative made with Spanish subtitles in Buenos Aires, which turned up in the same collection where The Long Metropolis did. And and this was
funny, sort of thinking of them side
exactly,
by side.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have to think of these films as side by side. I have to think, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny you should say this, but yeah, for me, it's just they are side by side.
Yes.
But the only way I think that this came to my attention, there was a film, I can't remember the title, but it had, who's the English actor who's in, what's the Matthew Vaughn film, the Kingsman,
who plays,
I've forgotten his name. He played Mr. Darcy in the BBC TV series of Pride and Prejudice in the 90s. I completely Colin Firth.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So he acts in this film, and there's an element, there's part of the film, which he opens an art film in Buenos Aires, and then the end of the film, it ends with a tracking shot, which reveals that he sold out, and that his art film is now a porno theatre. And then there's this slow tracking shot when the camera goes back, and you realise, you see all the posters, and this is like the reveal when you, all the Amicord and things like that have been displaced by these exploitation films. And then there's like one poster which is identical to Café Flesh called Café Porno. And I mentioned this to the director and he didn't know anything about it. Then I realised in fact that the film actually had been distributed in South America, in Spanish countries, in Spanish version, under the title of Café Porno.
Okay, it wasn't a parody, it was...
No, it was actually, it's the same poster, the same film, and then I actually contacted the archive, because they'd actually made a print from this internegative with Spanish subtitles, from their copy, and then clearly the film at some point had gone into distribution in South America, into Spanish language territories. And I would have thought they dubbed it, but apparently they subtitled it. I've not seen it myself, but that was the copy that was in that archive, and it was the same archive and archivist who encountered The Long Metropolis. So I do think that stuff like that does happen, and I think that mm-hmm. I mean it's slightly more banal, but there's this case in Poland. I used to live in Warsaw in this district called Powiśle, which means next to the Wisła, the river which runs through Warsaw. It's like the
right.
central residential district. And in the streets, when I was walking backwards and forwards to my girlfriend, there was like, there used to be before the war, it was the centre of the Jewish film industry and, of course, the centre of the Yiddish language cinema. And they made, you know, all the interior, the Michał Wyszyński film of Dybuk, based on the Anski play. They shot the exteriors in this town called Kazimierz Dolny, but they did all the studio work in Powiśle. So you have this huge concentration of Yiddish language films. But of course, because of the war, because of the Holocaust, these are all technically known in Poland as orphaned films.
Mm-hmm.
So the materials exist in the National Film Archive, but you can't really do much with them because who owns them?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that, you know, Kevin Brownlow, who I would say is, you know, my hero and an example about what you do about this in terms of basically interviewing people. Like, I mean, The Parade's Gone By is like the book, my bedside book. You know, I will never grow tired of reading those interviews he conducted with all those silent movie stars and filmmakers. But I think that Kevin Brownlow was saying only recently that there's still so much there to be discovered and sitting there in archives which hasn't been catalogued. You know, mm-hmm. how did the copy of Jakubowski's Deserter Nomads end up in Los Angeles? You know, it's incredible, but it did. And in the case of like this On the Silver Globe by Jaworski, I mean, that film didn't go in the archive. They just stacked cans of negative in a corridor of a studio in Wrocław. And by some miracle, nobody stole the cans, except one can. And it's interesting. I don't know if you remember. You remember? How can you forget the scene with the underground naked orgy?
How could anyone forget?
Yeah, well, somebody's stolen that can of negative.
Mm-hmm.
So during presumably martial law, somebody stole that reel of naked people and started printing photographs for personal or useful. So that is the only reel which was the negative was missing. So if you actually mm-hmm. look at the restoration, that you will know, and also the previous release prints, the same with the version which was cut together in 86 87, it's actually from the dupe negative. So if you look closely, you'll notice that the quality drops during the orgy, and that's simply because somebody stole that reel. And I hope they enjoyed themselves. That's all I can say.
Well, earlier when you were talking about Catholic Flesh, it made me think a little bit of Borowczyk. I'd wondered partly about where his reputation was prior to the restoration of his earlier films like Goto and his animation and those types of films, because he seemed to have become saddled with that title of pornographer towards the end of his film career. And I'd always kind of wondered if that had hurt the distribution and appraisal of his earlier films in the years that followed.
It was catastrophic, I would say. I mean, the first thing to say is that I think in many ways he was a victim of his own success, because his short films were extensively distributed in France, in England, Canyon Cinema in the States, and even in Poland amongst cine clubs. But the problem is that when films get played a lot, they fall apart, and then you have to make new prints, or you don't make new prints. And I think so. My first encounter with the film, there was a Jan Schwank. It was the time of Faust by Jan Schwankmeyer, and a great writer and film programmer called Michael O'Pray. He was commissioned to make a touring program of shorts to accompany Faust, and it was actually not one program, it was like four or five. And it was like Schwankmeyer and his peers. And his peers included both Borowczyk, Lenitzer, and the Quay brothers. And I went to I was very, very lucky in the way that my local film theatre was programmed by Peter Hames, who wrote the Czechoslovak New Wave.
Yes.
And he was writing a book on Schwankmeyer at the time, or editing a book of essays. And he chose a program, and he introduced the screening, and it had three short films by Borowczyk: the Le Jeu des Anges, Rosalie, and the Phonograph. And they absolutely blew me away. I mean, the prints were 16mm falling apart. I mean, Le Jeu des Anges was completely pink. So was the Phonograph. But Peter was incredibly generous, and he gave me an interview, a transcript of an interview with Borowczyk, which was made for a television documentary. And it really inspired me to seek out Borowczyk and seek out the films. And the problem at that point is that you could still hire 16mm and 35mm prints of the films at that point. So I organised a retrospective of his films, just at the shorts and the animation in Bradford in 98, at the National Museum of Photography, Film and Television. And then, I was young at the time, I had this great idea that I was going to rediscover Borowczyk. So I did this huge retrospective at the Lux Centre, which was the London Filmmakers Co-op. And I invited Borowczyk, and at first he agreed. And we printed all the promotional material that Borowczyk was going to come. And then about 2 weeks before, he wrote back and said, "I'm not going in front of those prints. Those aren't my films. Those are bits of film with holes punched in them." And it was interesting, because at the time, looking back now, I kind of got used and accepted the fact that old films looked scratched, dusty, and pink. It was like normal, and I couldn't understand this problem. But it really sowed the seed of, like, okay, how do we make new prints? And at that point, it was like conversations with both him and Argos Films about paying for new 35mm prints, because that's what it was in the late 90s. It was, you pay so many thousands of pounds to make a new print from an inter negative or something.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I could never raise the money for that, particularly for those films. I mean, they made a new copy of The Beast, because The Beast never got proper distribution in the UK. It was only within cinema clubs. So The Beast was released in 2001. But for films like Goto and The Shorts, it didn't happen. But it only really happened when he died. I was actually working with Jakubisko at the time. I was in Prague working on Bathory. I actually screened the Bathory episode from Amoral Tales to Jakubisko and his cameraman. Cameramen, there were two of them, Jan Juris and František Brabec. And then this was February, and yeah, he died. And then there was a programmer called Adam Pugh, and he said we've got to do something in Norwich. And so we did an event, and I invited the Quay brothers and Andrzej Klimowski, because they'd encountered the short films in Goto at the Royal College of Art and St. Martin's College in London. So I really wanted to focus on the shorts and the early features, and I thought it would be great to invite a graphic designer and the Quay brothers to talk about that work, rather than constantly going on about this later work, which I do love, but it's just I really hate this position of constantly having to defend it, and I just don't bother anymore. And I just, so it was a case of basically presenting these films, discussing them, and at one moment I screened a DVD of Le Jeu des Anges, and the idea was that they would give a live commentary. That was my idea. It didn't happen. Everybody just went silent, and we all watched the movie. And then afterwards, I just said into the microphone, you know, again, I was younger than I am now. I just said, it's a crime that there's no good copy of this film.
That's the Holocaust-themed animated short, right?
Well, Borowczyk never said it was, and this is what's so interesting, in the way that it is and it isn't, in the way that, mm-hmm, basically it's got that text in English, French and Russian saying that everything depicted in this film has no resemblance to anything that happened. But of course, that's just focusing your attention on the fact that it is about something. And I agree with you. I think there's no... Canyon Films, they added a card, and that copies still on YouTube, I think, when it says this film is about the concentration camps, which I think is rather unfortunate, because Borowczyk went out of his way to make it not explicitly about the concentration camps. But it's not explicit. But somebody was in the audience, a guy called George Clark, who was working for the Independent Cinema Office, and he was putting together a programme of short films called Dreams, which was like an anthology of surrealistic films. It had Maya Darren, Binwell, and he had money to make two new prints, and he decided to make a print of Our Lady of the Spheres by Larry Jordan, which is incredible, and also he wanted to do a new print of Le Jeu des Anges. So that was the first time we could start the process of actually making a new print. So this was 2006 or 7, I think, something like that. So at that point, I got a taste for making a new copy. And then when I was working with this German distributor, Bildstörung, Argos Films received the original short version of The Beast. And this is interesting. The original short film is called The True Story of the Beast of Gévaudan. And the archive which had the print had catalogued it under V for Véritable instead of B for Bête. So the films, the short versions, which I've been asking for like 20 years, and Argos Films were saying no, they've been lost. Suddenly, several copies of this short version get returned to Argos, and they explain that they've been catalogued wrong. And so I said, great, well, let's reconstruct this 5-episode version of Moral Tales. And we did that with Bildstörung, and we did that way before Arrow, and not in high definition because there wasn't the budget. But yeah, all that was done. So it was really exciting, the idea of actually, yeah, working with archival material. And how did that affect your perception of the film? And you could say that the Beast episode makes the film lopsided in terms of, and there is a dramatic reason for taking it out, because it's just like, how do you follow the Beast? You know, I mean, it really does take out the energy of the Bathory. I mean, the Bathory episode, I think, is remarkable.
The Bathory one's my favorite. Me too. Bunch, actually,
yeah. It's stunning, but it really does take the edge off that film, because you're still recovering from the Beast episode. And I think that's really what Borowczyk was doing, in the way that it really undersold the Bathory episode.
Right.
But it was an interesting experiment, and it was also interesting to, I mean, all the promotional material, like the posters and the stills, they all make it very clear that the film is to be accompanied with the Private Collection short film. So on those DVDs, we made it an option so that you would play the 5-episode version or the 4-episode version, or a combination of the two with the short. And of course, we did this in a more sophisticated version with the Arrow release. And it's interesting, when you look at the film with that documentary or pseudo-documentary prelude, it suddenly turns into a more kind of Makaveyev-type film, when you're mixing kind of quotation with documentary and archival footage. So I think it is interesting to look at those different versions of the film. Again, not recognizing what is definitive.
Were there any other big surprises from going from how you remembered a film, or how you first experienced a film, compared to the final restoration or final presentation along the way? If there was some discovery or some shock that maybe it wasn't how you expected it to be?
I think the Silver Globe by far, because I think there were a lot of visual details which I just didn't see, and I think there's an awful lot of actors' performances when you just don't register the facial expressions because of the dark and the prints. So I'd say that the Silver Globe more than anything. And yeah, it was nice to see Chris D'Elia of My Car, yeah, as well, because, you know, there's so much going on in that, in the, yes, the visual space, and when you actually see that in.
I noticed you could actually see the photographs on the walls now. I think I noticed a baby Alexei German photograph up there, and some of the paintings. And on the DVD, you could, the old, I don't know, the Russian whatever DVD art that I bought, you could hardly see any of that. So, for a film that's so rich in detail, it's important to have it up to that quality. Well, thank you for coming on and having this conversation with me and being so generous with your time. I spent most of it nodding, and I learned so much. Thank you very much.
Well, no, thank you. And really, it was a thrill to read particularly the German film by film account. I mean, I personally learned so much from that particular coverage, and it's a thrill to read somebody so much engaged in these films, because it can feel like a very small club.
Yeah.
So thank you for opening that audience to a much broader audience.
Well, thank you again. And if there's anywhere online you'd like to direct folks to, or anything you'd like to plug?
I guess right now is the second sight edition of The Color of Pomegranates.
Right.
Given the fact that it's certainly the kind of groundwork to much of the work which I'm involved in at the moment. But that's the only thing I can say. So.
All right. So I guess if folks want to follow this show, it's on flixwise.com. I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. And until next time, listeners, take care.
Thank you very much, and take care.